Tobias Carlyle is the founder and principal of Acquires Funds. For regulatory reasons, we will not discuss any of the Acquires Funds on this podcast. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Acquires Funds or affiliates. For more information, visit acquiresfunds.com.
I was about to play Stairway.
Play it. Play it.
Yeah, dude. This is live All entertainment.
Right. Now we're live. It says we're live anyway. It's going to sneak up. This is the part where I'm always talking, saying, is this live? Is this live? And then I get to watch it back. And yeah, it was. It was live then. What's up, folks?
I still don't see it on the YouTube machine.
I think it's delayed a little bit.
Okay.
Hello.
It's 10:35 on the West Coast. We're a little bit late. Sorry, folks. It's 1:30 p.m. East Coast.
It's actually 1:35. We didn't.
1:35 also.
We're also on the same time frame.
That's strange. Is that how that works? I always wondered. How did California get so far behind?
I don't know. It was a long series of regulations.
What's up, folks? Yeah, I got a brand new background. Unfortunately, the light is coming from the opposite side, so it doesn't quite work, but maybe I'll figure that out. Maybe I'm not going to worry about it. I don't know.
I don't think anybody would know if you didn't say that. It's not like the light's hitting one half of your face.
It's the aesthete in me that wants it all attractive. The artist. What are we talking about today, gents? What's happening?
I think I'm going to talk a little bit about Disney Plus.
JT?
I was hoping for some cigarette talk, Bill.
I could do that.
Okay, good. I've got a little veggie segment on the Dutch winter famine, so that should be real uplifting.
And I'll be talking about Francois Rochon. Had a great tweet today that... Or he had a great line that I tweeted out when he said, there's not much difference between 20 and 25 earnings. There is between 20 and 60, but between 20 and 25, I'm trying to be too prudent. So I want to discuss that. Is this, is that a bull market special, or is this the brave new world?
Oh, let's start with that. I like that.
Go with that.
Yeah.
Let me read it out. So So Francois Giverny, I love the name of that fund, of that firm. There's not much difference between 20 and 25 times earnings. There is between 20 and 60, but between 20 and 25, I'm trying to be too prudent and miss the big picture. If you find a great company and it doubles its earnings every 5 years, valuation should be flexible. That's me paraphrasing, but that's what he said.
Yeah, that makes sense to me because 25 to 20, you're giving up roughly like 20%. Right in the valuation bleed. And what if you're doubling your earnings? So you're up 100, down 20, it's 80%. You're up 80 over what, 5 years? Like you're still doing pretty well. I mean, you're compounding north of 15%, but from 60 to 20, you're fucked. And that's a technical term.
Well, here's the thing, right? It's not so much the, I got no problem with the mathematics of it. It's the likelihood of something doubling every 5 years. And in addition to that, it's this, you know, well, we're talking about earnings, right? We're talking 20 or 25 times earnings. Out of that, you got some reinvestment and you've got some dividends. Like it's not, that's not 20, 25 times free cash flow.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he would probably say that he's using earnings as a rough proxy. That dude knows his stuff. I don't think, I'm not going to go at him for not knowing his stuff. So I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and think he's maybe talking.
I'm not disputing.
Yeah, I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying, I think he would probably agree with your comment.
Well, let me do a little inversion here. And what's the difference then? Like what you're really trying to do is protect against, you know, compression of, you know, by not overpaying, right? Not paying 60 means that if there is compression in the earnings, and even if it was to grow a lot, you get multiple fade like that, like you're going to get hurt. So you don't want to overpay. All right. Well, what's the difference then between, like, why not 30 then instead of 25? Well, going back to 15 times, which is the long run normal for an average business, like that's a 50% fade. I don't see a big difference between 25 and 30 on the fade. So going the other direction, like what's the difference between 30 and 25?
What do you mean? You're saying why not
pay up to 30 then? If you're, what you're worried about is fade, then the difference between 25 and 30 fading back to 15 is not really that big a deal.
Well, I think that you can pay a lot if you're that confident that the earnings are going to grow over time. I mean, I do think this is where some of the growth guys on these smaller businesses, like small and rich, I still think can deliver you really good returns. But I do understand the base rates are not in your favor. But I think that these guys that are doing like really, really deep work would argue that you're right, the base rates aren't in your favor, and that's what we get paid to figure out, is the difference between the base rate and the outlier. And like, that's why we make our money.
Agreed 100%. But the base rate of you thinking that you have some special talent might be less than what is currently self-assessed in today's market.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I think in anything, most people fail. Like, I don't care if it's business. I don't care if it's most customer relationships. I don't care like what it is. Almost everything that I've seen follows a power law where, like, I hate to be like one of these winners win guys, but, there's like, you know, I don't know, the average person that plays football sucks at football relative to the best. And, I do agree that, like, if you're the average investor, I think this is the case for indexing or using some computer assisted tool or becoming a quant. Like, I think that makes a ton of sense. But I think a guy like him, I mean, he's made his career by proving that he's pretty close to the outlier, I think.
It's a good bigger topic, though, of outliers versus base rates and knowing which game that you're trying to play.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Is that something, I mean, this is something that you hear at the end of, well, not necessarily the end, but well into a very long bull market. I mean, I don't know where we are in this.
The middle of it.
The middle of it, yeah. It just seems to me that it's been, you know, it's pervasive. Everybody says, well, you don't buy cyclicals, you buy compounders, and you really, the only mistake you can make is not paying up.
Yep.
I don't think that's quality. What he's saying, right? I mean, he said, like, don't pay 60% or 60 times earnings. So he's not saying don't pay up. I think what he's saying is, like, if you think you have a really good business and you have some, like, mental thing in your head where 20 is your maximum, there is a level to stretch to that is not, you know, you should probably stretch. Now, where you should stretch to is, I think, like a very, very reasonable argument to be had. You know,
let's reframe the question. Do you think that having hard rules, like I will never pay more than 20 times or 25 or 30 or whatever it is that your cutoff is, helps you or hurts you in general?
I think it depends what game you're playing.
Toby, what do you think?
Well, I mean, why not pay 60 times earnings?
Well, it depends how big the earnings stream is, right? I mean, like that's sort of, if you go back to like when Buffett bought Coke, if you could foresee the growth and you actually thought you could see it, then I almost don't even view it as like, who gives a shit on current multiple of earnings? It's how big can your earnings base get? How much reinvestment do you need to get to that rate? How levered is your current balance sheet? How levered could it be? How much return could you get? And what are you paying as a grossed up number? Like, I wouldn't even view it on a multiple basis. I'd be like, I'm buying this for $4 billion. And I think it's going to return this much money over time. That's how I would think about it. I wouldn't even think about multiples, especially small.
But if you're so confident that it's going to double every 5 years, So what's that? That's like a 15% underlying growth in the. Is that right? Oh, it's probably roughly around that kind of number.
Yeah.
Rule of 72
divided by 5. Yeah. Or 72 like divided by 5.
14 or 15. If you're confident that it's going to do that, so that means in 5 years' time, it's on 30 times earnings. 5 years after that, it's on 15, right? So 10 years' time, you're going to have a company that's on 15 times earnings, which is the average. So you're saying that the fade is average to, like, that's right, isn't it?
A relatively appropriate price, right? It's not really discounted at 60 then.
No, but it's the fair value.
That's so fair
anything under that is, and then you're getting that's getting no return, right? So you're getting no return at 60 times earnings if you fade to 15 multiple after 10 years. Yeah.
Yep.
Want a little bit more than no return, I think.
Well, but I guess that like, what is
that's my bold statement today. I want more than no return for the next decade.
It's a good one. That's the takeaway.
Well, you're not going to be a central banker anytime soon.
I mean, that's going to be tough to do in this market. That's genuinely tough to do. I think that sounds insane, but I look at the implied returns on the market at the moment are going to be, excluding the dividends,
strong,
they're negative.
Quite strong.
Excluding the dividends, we're at like negative 0.7% plus 1.4 or 5% in dividends gets you to plus 0.7 to 0.8.
But what are you assuming that things fade to?
Yeah, the long run average at like 16 times, I think 16 times on a CAPE basis.
I just don't know that I can get down with that argument because like I don't even Google growing at 3%. A year, like let's assume that everybody's growing top line at 3%, which is not an accurate assumption.
That's inflation.
Yeah.
GDP.
Well, like,
yeah.
I mean, this is how I'm framing this is really stupid, but not like all businesses aren't going to trade at the average. This is actually something that I'd love to talk to Nigrin about because they fade their exit multiple to a market average. And it just doesn't make any sense to me because like, if you think of, let's think of real estate for a second. And then it's like, okay, well you're paying, a 3 cap in for Chicago, like class A real estate, but isn't it just going to fade to the average? It's like, no, it's Chicago class A real estate. You got to fade it to the average of the comp set that you're comparing it to. I don't think that thinking that all businesses will fade to average or revert to average is I've never been comfortable with that idea.
Yeah, I understand
that. I'm very comfortable with that idea. Enough timeline.
Yeah, I mean, I guess.
I have been thinking about that too, because I build these little models that have a fade over 10 years. And I'm like, why do you fade something that's like 60% return on invested capital, fade that to average versus something that's a 30% return on invested capital faded to average over 10 years. It's not fair to the 30% return on invested capital, assuming everything else is the same, because the one that's earning 60, did I say it's not fair to the 61? It's because the 61 should, everything else being equal, it's twice as good. It's not fair to fade it that quickly. Whereas it should have a, I don't know exactly how you build it out, but you say it fades at a fixed rate and therefore the 60 should fade slower than the 30 or should get back to average slower, like should take twice as long maybe to get back to average.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like one of the things that I'm thinking of is like Hermes. I mean, Hermes has been Hermes since my grandma was a little girl. It has never, everyone that has ever said this brand is going to fade has been completely fucking wrong. So, is that the outlier? Yes. But like Ferrari too. I think that you can look at what that brand has done. Disney has gone through some really bad spouts. So, maybe media assets are slightly less durable. Maybe luxury is just this version of CPG and maybe luxury is all of a sudden going to get hammered. I don't know. But what I do know is like, I just don't think Hermes is an 18 times business. It's very, very hard for me to get my head around why that would be a valid assumption under any type of like reasonable circumstance that's actually foreseeable other than, well, it must happen. But like, that's not really valid to me.
It's fashion, right? It's hard. There's for every Hermes, there's dozens of others that have like completely disappeared or ruined their brand.
But that's the point. There's only one. So that's not an average business. Yes, I agree. Michael Kors and Hermes are like way different. Michael Kors, Polo, Coach, all that shit's the same. Hermes is different. So like those should trade at a multiple that is what that multiple is. Hermes is a completely different animal.
Why?
Because it is. Because they treat that brand with the respect that it needs, because they control distribution, because it's not a mass market thing that's got, you know, 10,000 stores all over Michigan Avenue and they can't wait to expand because they restrict the supply. Like you
wait
can't
until
just...
I get a CEO who comes in and says, you know what we need to do? We need masstige because we're being left behind by all these other guys who are selling.
Okay, well, then you sell. Then you sell. Then you don't even fucking wait for the fade. You just sell.
But for a period of time, they're going to make a lot of money.
No, you sell. You're out. It's a fundamental strategy shift that makes no sense. I wouldn't sit around and wait for the numbers to prove that at all. I think then you get waxed. Like that's I think the game that I mean that's the game I play. I don't know what other people do. If I don't agree with the strategy, it's why I sold Comcast. I don't agree with their strategy in their media assets at all, and I don't know how to handicap how much money they're going to burn. Brian Roberts is a great CEO. I hope the people that are long it make a lot of money. I know the stock's cheap relative to other cable assets. I don't agree with their strategy, so I'm out. And like that's how I invest.
So your topic is going to be Disney, so I'm just going to front run it a little bit. But there was a I missed the name of it. There was a guy talking today on one of the networks about they have an ETF that gets rid of the companies that they think are going to be. So I guess they're giving you the index, but they're taking out of that index the stuff that they don't think deserves to be in the index. And one of the companies that they took out was Disney.
For what? What index?
They have, so say it's the S&P 500, but then you've got to take out certain names that they think are going to be, I think they were talking about technological obsolescence. I think that was kind of their idea.
That's called the NASDAQ.
They think Disney is going to be technologically obsolete?
Dude, I was surprised.
They're out of their minds.
Well, if anything, like Disney's trying to make the leap, right? Or Disney's made the leap. Like Disney's probably a bigger threat to
those people are crazy
to Netflix.
They're free to sell whatever product they want. They're wrong.
What? How would you discern what is technologically obsolescent or at risk there? I mean,
I wish I'd been paying a little more attention. But the you know, there was some stuff in there like Visa hit the road, Visa.
I mean, here's some things that like I would be really uncomfortable with. I don't like the idea of shitty brands thinking they're going to become luxury. Restoration Hardware is probably the only one that I've seen any evidence of being able to pull it off. But like when Volkswagen tried to go up market with the Phaeton or whatever, that was garbage. If anybody thinks that Coach can actually become like a real luxury brand, their leather goods are fine. But like, they diluted their brand with all those damn sea bags and stuff. And like, once you do that and it's that visual, I just don't think, I guess Gucci kind of came back, but they never like really sold out. One that may be in the process that somebody's been hitting me up about is Harley Davidson. That may be worth looking at. And the person that's been hitting me up, like pretty much bottom tick that. So shout out to you. But, you know, I don't know. I don't like brands turning around. But luxury that's remaining luxury and executing, I can get comfortable with that.
I found some of the other names that they're kicking out. I don't know if I can tell I don't know what the underlying pattern is here, but they've kicked out Walmart, Disney, Berkshire, Exxon, Chevron, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, Verizon, AT&T.
So anything that hasn't been doing very well lately?
Yeah, it feels a little bit that way, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
momentum kicking up.
Yeah,
momentum.
That's just a momentum guy.
Maybe that's what it is.
I mean, there's one comment that says, I think it's harder than it seems. I mean, I guess that the thing that I don't like about the comment of it's harder than it seems is I don't understand why anyone should think that anything in the market is going to be easy. like, if you are trying to make money in the stock market, it's going to be really, really hard. Otherwise, just index. And then, like, you don't have to worry about it. But, like, buying value stocks is not easy. Like, there's nothing easy about underperforming year after year after year, waiting for some cyclical to re-rate and hoping that you sell it and go find another. In the same way that there's nothing easy about playing a game where you're paying up and waiting for asset quality to change. Like, all of these games are really, really hard. The question is, what risk are you comfortable living with and what can you execute, in my opinion? I think where value has a little bit of an edge in that argument is historically the odds are better on your side.
Yeah, I saw somebody said the other day that some firm said that the last century was the century of value. And so this century is the century of growth or momentum.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's the end decade on that data set of centuries?
1920.
Two centuries worth of data.
Not enough ends.
I think the really tough thing is, like, some of these, you know, like I'm talking about luxury. Well, it's really easy. I think CPG is what I keep coming back to. But back in the day, you know, look at what happened to Buffett on Kraft Heinz, right? It was like monitoring when the shift happens and how the shift happens. I mean, I think that's really, really, you know, tough. And if you're paying a rich multiple and the shift happens, you're going to take a write down on that asset. You don't run a portfolio of N equals one assets. And a lot of the big money and a lot of the guys that I really respect have been made holding the assets for really long times, even when they've been rich. And that's like, that's the thing that's really hard for me to get my head around, right? Because Ben Graham, the god of value investing, made most of his money in Geico. So how do you square that circle?
What's the similarities between IBM and Kraft Heinz, which are both sort of notable Buffett missteps? No growth, lack of growth.
I don't know that much about IBM. I think Kraft was just like, I think they levered up to buy a set of assets at the wrong time. Like, sometimes you just do deals and stuff doesn't work out. Like, I don't know that's just kind of life.
He comes from a world where, you know, you had that three channels or two channels and you had the supermarket end cap, and basically you could dominate by shoving advertising down the tube, and then you could spend enough money to kind of control the grocery aisle, and yeah, that was the way that you exercised your pricing power.
Yeah, I mean, I think the grain of truth or what opened the door for Kraft Heinz failure, and this is not scientific, so don't assume it's right, but is when we went through the Great Recession, people really got comfortable with private label brands. And then once I think people got comfortable with private label brands, the grocery stores started to feature them a little bit more. And as they started to feature them a little bit more, that shelf space and mind share that Kraft Heinz sort of like click were brand image and like how people used to buy shifted. And all of a sudden 365 was as good as, you know, mac and cheese. And all of a sudden Kirkland became this real brand that people really cared about. And now all of a sudden, like, you know, you get some stuff on the internet. And where I think that's kind of similar, and one of the reasons that I'm still like nervous about watching how TransDigm trades from here is I think that this, what we just lived through, could be the thing that changed. Not like, I think people are going to fucking rage. Like, don't get me wrong. I live in Florida. People are raging. I assure you of that. If anyone that thinks that life's not getting back to normal is out of their mind. But I do think that business travel may seriously be impaired, because I do think a lot of companies have figured out we can cut a lot of costs and not lose that much. And that's not to say that people aren't going to get on airplanes anymore, right? There's nuance in this discussion. But little changes in utilization can have big impacts.
Especially on high operational leverage businesses, yeah. Like airlines and hotels and...
Yeah, and TransDigm's better. They have a lot of variable costs. But yeah, they got a big debt stack. And, you know, I don't know. It's just... That's what I wonder 10 years forward if we look back and we say, boy, travel really was kind of like the, you know, that was kind of the kink in travel's armor that that private label was to CPG. Maybe not. I mean, I don't know. I'm going to get on a plane, but
I'm always astonished how small the airlines are relative to, you know, I don't know exactly where these are. The last time I looked at the numbers, the airlines were like $30 billion market caps, I think. And you know, you got Google out there at $1.7 trillion. Like Google could buy an airline just to fly its people around.
It could, but it would deteriorate the business.
It wouldn't be great for the business, but it'd be, you know, it's just like they probably earn enough in a quarter to buy an airline outright. And they just use it for Google employees.
Yeah, as they should.
I mean, in the future, we're all going to be either Facebook, Amazon, Google, like employees like that. And that's going to be our tribe. We're going to go to war as, you know, Amazon.
Blue paint smeared on your
face. Yeah, that's it. The logo.
Except we're all going to end up working for Facebook because they're going to own all of the actual underlying. Just some of us will be on different teams. We'll have the WhatsApp team, the Instagram team. All the olds will be crippling around there with their Facebook paint on. Viagra.
You'll be on the internet. You'll never leave the ecosystem of like Google's. Google owns a whole lot of servers. Like you just never leave the Google ecosystem.
Yeah, it'd be like internet fiefdoms that you're a part of.
Yeah, yeah, Apple too.
Jesus. The young kids will be all Discorded out. That's Snapchat. And I'll still be trying to figure out what this color is that's attacking me.
Spacking their NFTs.
That's a bleak spacking future. An NFT is kind of sexy. I like that.
Let's move on. Let's do another topic.
Well, I was just going to talk about Disney and I can talk about cigarettes real quick too. But I was watching Disney and it's just amazing to me what Disney Plus is doing for that franchise. And the thought that I sort of had was, you know, the WandaVision show, I didn't personally care for, but the numbers you can't really lie with or argue with. And then when I was watching Falcon and Winter Soldier, I mean, they're going to get like 6 hours of content out of something that would probably be a 2.5 hour, maybe 3 hour movie. So you're like doubling your potential, you know, time that you can view people. And then all of a sudden, like, shout out to Francisco for this idea. I don't want you to say I didn't cite you for it, but like it elevates, like those, characters, right? So now maybe somebody didn't care about, you know, Winter Soldier as a figurine, but like now they really do. And the way that they're going to be able to introduce characters, it's just, it's wild to watch and to think about. And I guess like when I saw the Disney Plus announcement, like I knew it was big, but now like actually seeing how big it was is wild. And it's really cool to see how those assets are going to be able to be flexed. And I guess that where I think it's relatable, or why I think it's maybe an important lesson is like when I listen to Ron Barron talk about Vail. The way that he saw that investment and the way that he thought through like the location of the assets and what they might be able to do with hotels and how they might be able to invest. Like, I think that's the key for figuring out like where growth can go and then updating priors, right? And thinking through like, okay, well, how does this change how I'm going to think about this, this, and this? It's a fascinating game to play. I don't know that you can do it with precision, but it's been interesting to watch. I talked to Sanjay on the other pod about it a little bit with Shopify, right? Like how do you think through holding something like that? And I think what people do, not necessarily him or WCM, but just generally, is some people that I respect have told me that they try to think 5 years out, how could this double, right, earnings? And they keep asking that question. And they try to focus on that. And then once they can't answer that, then maybe it's a sell. But as long as they see a path, they hold. It's kind of an interesting thought. I don't know what to do with it. You're all along.
I like the approach. I like the idea. I love Shopify as a, if valuation was no obstacle, I think Shopify is my favorite.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
My favorite business. My run by my favorite managers. Right?
Yeah. It's like attacking Goliath.
It's got everything. It's distributed. So it's not like you can hate, you know, if you have a bad experience, it's unlikely that you blame Shopify. You blame, as opposed to Amazon, like you get some scammy item from Amazon, which happens more and more frequently. You know, sort of now I'm a little bit suspicious of the stuff that's on Amazon. That doesn't happen with Shopify.
Dude, you know what's wild about that is I don't even trust Amazon reviews and I still go to Amazon to order.
It's very convenient.
Yeah. So what actually matters, right? But it's convenience. It's not actually trust.
Yeah. But then, so we, you know, we bought
saving
a little,
time.
We bought a trike for my 3-year-old and because he likes the trike that the older kids have got. And it turned out it was, we thought we were buying the name brand thing and it turns out we were buying a knockoff and it fell apart like pretty quickly because he thrashes it pretty hard. So we had to go back in. And this time I was much more careful to like make sure I'm getting the, because even in the description, they said it was, you know, this car. And then I realized it was not, it was a cheaper knockoff.
Inspired by this guy.
Yeah, inspired by Clever. Came up in the, I don't know how, but I didn't even think about the fact that there'd be, you know, something that would be identical that would be a knockoff in there. And it's clearly like nowhere near as good.
So where'd you buy your next?
Walmart.
We just bought a bike from Walmart.
Obsolete. Sorry. Canceled.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's bizarre.
It's got to be a momentum run.
What is it, like 99% of the population lives within a half a mile of a Walmart or some craziness like that? It's not that.
Is that so?
No, that's like...
Yeah, but I'm saying, call it 70. You think it's that, like, it's one of those stats that's that shocking?
Yeah.
Huh.
I went online. We did it online. So that's...
Yeah, Walmart has that. It's called walmart.com?
Yeah, I mean...
No way they're going obsolete. They're on the internet.
Well, they made that acquisition, right? And that kind of changed...
Jet.com. That was $1 billion for nothing.
I think they wrote that one to zero, didn't they?
Yeah, but well, how are they doing that? They're fulfilling it somehow.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, even though it's like directly not... There's knowledge that they took out of that that's clearly like helping them now.
Put a website up?
No, I mean, like, it's like QVC, it's like QVC and Zulily, right? Like Zulily, I don't think is this asset that they thought they would get. And clearly, like, the acquisition has had problems, but there's a lot of retargeting ad tech that they got out of it. And I do think that there's some cultural stuff that Zulily probably helps them with. You know, I don't know what I think. I don't know if they should sell it or not. I don't know what the hell they should do. Greg Maffei. Hopefully he knows. Yeah, that's the bet.
That is the bet.
Is that so he's smart?
Given that the cigarette stocks have taken a whack, what's going on there?
I guess that the Biden administration is considering lowering the amount of nicotine.
The smoking
in
age.
Cigarettes. yeah, that's right. Lowering the nicotine percentage per stick.
Isn't that good for them? Doesn't it mean you got to buy more?
Dude, that's what I thought. Somebody said that there's some study out there that says that after you reduce the amount of nicotine in cigarettes, smoking... I've seen a couple things. One, I've seen that smoking amount remains unchanged. Some people have said that like it goes to a lower adoption cycle or something like that.
Less addictive.
All I can tell you is I think finance, I love y'all, whoever's listening, but like sometimes I think that people nerd out way too much and don't know people that are addicted to shit. And my sense is that if people knew how much people fiend for nicotine, they'd probably throw away the studies and just like watch how people huff cigs. I'm with you, Toby. I think pack sales are going up. And if pack sales aren't going up, I think those nicotine pouches are going to go up.
Isn't that why they put nicotine in it to begin with?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's
why it works. They don't have to like put it in there, do they?
Well, okay. Just watch like a light beer drinker, right? People that in my experience that are heavy drinkers, if you watch them drink light beer, they don't get less drunk. They just drink a lot more beer.
Yeah. So like 12 pack.
Like, yeah, they just like crushed 12 of them instead of four. So maybe that's not right. But the other comment that I thought was pretty smart is they were like, oh, there's going to be a run on full nicotine cartons in the next, ooh, you know,
give me the hard stuff.
Yeah.
What about the vaping? Can you get different levels of, you must be able to get different levels of nicotine in vapes.
My vape knowledge is lower than it probably could be. I think one of the things that's, going to be interesting to watch is Juul was, you know, the subject of all that regulatory stuff back in the day. And by back in the day, I mean within a couple of years. But
during the last presidency.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which feels like 1,000 years ago at this point.
Yes, it does. But then they just had this PMTA process that like required a lot of money to get through, which basically you had to certify that you knew that your products weren't getting sold to children. And the irony in that is many of these smaller producers didn't have the money to get through the PMTA process. So
regulatory capture, baby.
There we go.
Yeah. So to me, like, I understand why people want to say like, oh, this is going to hurt the cigarette companies and stuff, but I just haven't ever seen anything that does.
Nothing hurts cigarette companies.
I just don't believe it. The only thing that hurts them is people dying. And that hasn't even stopped the cash flows.
It's crazy that there have been studies out since the 60s saying these things kill you. People are like, well, probably not me. Base rates don't apply to me.
Yeah, or people, I mean, I don't know, like people like drugs.
Yeah, it kills you at the end of your life, not at the beginning. So, you know, don't worry about it until you get to the end.
You're just cutting off the crappy years. I don't actually think that's how it works.
You're pulling forward the crappy years. You're cutting off the good years.
That's right. That's real talk. No, that's real. Don't demonetize us, YouTube.
Oh, we're probably gone for this one. There's $1.38 out the window.
Is it $1.38 now? That's been a lot of hard work to get to that.
Nah, it's probably a bit higher than that at this point. I don't know.
Fair.
All right, since we're in negative deaths and everything, should we do some veggies on the Dutch winter famine?
Yes.
Sure.
Give the people they want.
Yeah. All right, so let's transport ourselves back to towards the end of World War II. And you know, food supplies are really scarce in the Netherlands. And it's currently being, most of it is being occupied by Germany. And the Dutch government that existed at that time organized a railway strike that pissed the Germans off because they couldn't like move their stuff around inside of Germany because they were occupying it, or inside of the Netherlands because they were occupying it. And the Germans put up a food embargo. And it was really hard also for the other, like the Allied, to get supplies and food to the Dutch, because all the ports were all bombed out. And like, I mean, the place was just in shambles. So food stocks rapidly declined for about 4.5 million people who were living there. And adult rations in Amsterdam dropped to below 1,000 calories per day in November of 1944. And then in below 580 calories per day in February of 1945. So I don't know if you guys have you guys done much like kind of playing around with fasting at all ever?
Yeah. Yeah. But that's very, very little.
But not probably in a for like months on end at a metabolic rate.
No. Nothing like
that. I think
that.
If you look at my body, you'd know I don't fast.
That was a rhetorical question.
Fair.
So anyway, like it's obviously pretty rough, right? And people also happening at that same time, like gas and electricity were and heat were all shut off with this in the middle of the war. So they had like young people who were relatively healthy would walk 10 to 20 kilometers to out into the farm to trade their valuables for food and, you know, bring it back and try to feed the family. People resorted to actually eating like tulip bulbs and like beets and just like anything that they could gnaw on. And they started burning all their furniture to stay warm. I mean, it's pretty bleak. About 18,000 roughly people died directly from the famine, and probably many more from health related things. So all of this is very bleak and grave, right? But it did produce some interesting data, if you will, in sort of a scientific experiment, because you took a developed, you know, relatively advanced nation, and you basically like cut the food off for a period of time. So it gave us all kinds of a really interesting control group, basically, that we'd never really had before. So children of women who were exposed to the famine, and especially if you were in the third trimester during that winter, created these incredible long run problems. So what you ended up, the kids who were born from during that time are much more susceptible to diabetes, cardiovascular disease, schizophrenia. And they looked at it, and actually, it looks like possibly this PIM3 gene was like downregulated during that time period. And what ended up happening was then is it slowed their metabolism down. So like their bodies will store every calorie that it can get its hands on because of, you know, the lean conditions of this very, very important time period when they sort of like the printing was happening, you know, within the body. And it lasted not only through their lives, and obviously those kids were smaller than average, the ones who came out of that cohort. But what's interesting is that their kids were also smaller than average. So when you look at, you know, environment can silence or boost DNA, right? And the study of that long run control of DNA is called epigenetics. And so what we end up was that's like surprisingly, the children, it echoed for a couple generations after this time period where they had, you know, this shortage. Another interesting thing was they discovered that that actually like there was a connection between wheat and celiac disease. So you had all these kids in like a ward for a hospital that had celiac, and when the wheat got cut off due to the famine, all these kids miraculously recovered. And then when the foods came back, like wheat came back, they all like immediately relapsed. So that's how we figured out the connection between wheat and celiac disease.
How did celiac disease manifest? What was the?
I think it looks a lot like IBS. That. Yeah. So interestingly enough, like Audrey Hepburn was actually a child during that time period in the Netherlands. And even though she was obviously very wealthy, she had really poor health, you know, through the later half of her, you know, part of her life, where she had like anemia and respiratory illnesses and was just generally kind of unhealthy and couldn't really fix it. So that's sort of like some interesting background there of like, wow, we have this control group. Where I try to tie this back into finance and investing would be, I think, and part of it actually is like, reading some of these vignettes in William Green's new book about these different investors. But I think the time period of when you were printed on by, you know, what was happening has a huge impact and maybe even reverberates, you know, through your family, potentially like culturally, like sort of an epigenetics of culture, you know, within a family. So I think about for me personally, when I was really young, I had a great grandmother who was a really big influence on me. And she was in her late 20s and early 30s during the Great Depression. And so I think that kind of being frugal and I'm going to say miserly for lack of a better term, but like I feel that like I like saving. I like I get psychic benefit actually from depriving myself of things often. So and I think some of it's related to that mentality, like a depression era mentality that sort of imprinted upon me epigenetically in a way. And I try to put it on my kids as well. So I don't know. I think, you know, like I've heard Drunken Miller talk about how like if you're in a bull market, you do not want the old guys around. Like you want to get the young bucks in there who have never seen damage, have never like taken one on the chin, because they're going to be the ones that can push the hardest in that time period. So I don't
is
know,
that
just
a good thing, food.
Well, during the time period, it is, I think.
Until the end of it. Yeah. I mean, wasn't that the thing that's literally the thing that got him in trouble, wasn't it? He got two guys in right at the very top they tore up $1 billion or so.
So what, I mean, do you guys think that you have any, do you think that your value bent, Toby, at all, or Bill, like, is from something in your youth that sort of was an imprint?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I was a more traditional value investor until 2008, 2009. And I just, everything, the growthy stuff just got absolutely sliced or cut to smithereens, smashed to smithereens, cut to slivers.
What about when you were younger, though? I mean, I think a lot of us, I think it happened sooner than that.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, because it's not like there was no investing in my family. It wasn't like it was a thing. My grandparents were similarly a Great Depression and just never trusted the stock market. When my grandfather retired, he put all of his money in cash because cash was yielding like 16% at the time, but he never moved out of cash through his entire life and just gave me a few lectures on the dangers of the stock market.
Yeah. What do you think, Bill?
I don't really know. I don't have anything like that. I guess the one thing that I do wonder if, like, sometimes I don't mind running into fire, is like, I have heard stories of my grandma's grandfather. What, like, was really lighter fluid on his business was the Great Depression. And he was one of the few guys that was willing to write insurance during that because he had the capital to do so. And like, when everybody else was really down on their luck, like, he just grew market share like crazy. At least that's how the story has been told to me. And actually, like, AP Giannini at Bank of America did something similar when, I think it was the San Francisco fires or something like that. So I've always, like, identified, with, I mean, maybe that was the reason that I was willing to buy some, like, levered shit in March, you know? And I, when I say shit, I don't mean shit. I think TransDigm's a good company, but, like, maybe that's why I was slightly more willing to just be like, no, this is kind of nuts, and swing a little bit. But I don't know. I do think that I would be lying if I said that I didn't live a pretty nice life monetarily. And maybe that's why I'm able to identify with, like, some of these luxury goods a little bit better. I don't know.
All right. Well, I think we've killed this one. We got time for some questions.
Yeah, throw some questions. That was a good one.
I definitely think that, like, the time that, like, I do worry that the time that I've become professional has coincided with, you know, like, a real re-rating of growth, and how much of that is colored, like, how I see the world and how much of that is real and how much is not. I mean, I do try to be cognizant of, but.
I mean, that's the main argument, right? In for any kind of investor, you don't have to be a value investor, but is this change that we have seen, is this secular or is this cyclical? And which group you fall into sort of dictates how you invest through this period. And I just can't get away from the fact that I think that there have been cycles like this before, and this is unusual, and we're going to down cycle, but that's by no means the only view that's out there. It might even be the minority view out there.
Well, and I think the other thing that's tough is, like, I mean, after 10 years, it's the Meb Faber God portfolio, right? Like, how many people are still in business that are able to make that argument? Because at some point it's like, all right, but you're going to go out of business. So there's,
I mean, it's more than 10 years now. It's like March 2009, we're through April 2021. So we're like 12 years in. Is there anything that's even remotely close?
Well, we did have a pretty big panic in March, to be fair.
Well, I was going to say, do you think that little blip is going to be thrown out in history? If we do, let's say we have another 5-year run, is this like 2009 to 2026 going to be considered one bull market with just a little, sort of like 87 was a blip in the middle of a 82 to 99 run?
Yeah, I can see that.
Because there have been others too, which we're not, you know, which we now don't think about or talk about. There was the late 2015 one, and we had a good run in 2016. Then there was also late 2018, which, like, those have just completely passed by, just because I guess 2020 was a bigger drawdown, but it was also very sharp. It was over very quickly. And now we're now like 30 or 40% above where we were at the top of what was already a pretty stretched market, I would have thought at the time.
I guess that the one thing that I really... have been thinking about and need to think a lot more about is like, we all sit around and look at stock prices all day or not.
I shouldn't say,
yeah, I shouldn't frame it that way. But the discussions that we have are about stock prices and dislocations within the stock market. And one thing that Jason Buck said to me this Friday, when we sat down, you know, he's like, sometimes I kind of look at you guys and you're just like living in this little hovel and you're all like arguing over just the hovel and like you're not paying attention to all of the other asset classes out there. Right. So
that's fair.
Like, you know, maybe what we're talking about is actually just completely missing the real game. And we just happen to be like in this little hovel and we can't see anything else.
NFTs all in.
Well, no, but cuts. I said it last week, right? Like the currency debasement theory, I think is something that I need to spend more time thinking about. Now, I don't know what I do with it. Like, I don't know if I implement.
What's the currency debasement theory?
Well, just like if you just price these assets in hard assets and see how whether or not we're actually at highs.
Bitcoin.
This is like the Peter Schiff thing. Like
dividing everything by some denominator that's run up.
Well, I mean, but I guess that if gold has run up because it is a argument that the dollar is going down, right? Like I don't know how to figure out when you're like matching the right time series. I don't know how to figure out how you're measuring it when you start, when you end. But like, I do think that somebody like Schiff would say, well, the reason stocks are going up is the dollar is going down. So I just haven't spent a whole lot of time thinking about that because I study to a church that doesn't talk about that at all and says that those kind of thoughts are stupid. And I'm just not sure that I've spent enough time questioning that assumption.
Well, part of referring to the Shiller PE and other things like that and looking at the level of the market is to try to get an idea where the asset class is, you know, relative to other asset classes. So I use it relative to international markets, and I guess you could look at it relative to other, you know, I had an econometrics professor when I was in uni who used to like looking at gold, oil, and equities as three different groups. And he said, when you price each in the other, you see that they get these dislocations. So there's a chart that goes around every now and again that shows that we're, you know, some sort of commodities basket is unusually cheap now relative to the S&P 500. And that's because commodities have been beaten up and the S&P 500 is very, very expensive. And so that would suggest that you want to be more commodity focused than equities focused. But then
is that on like current earnings? Because commodities have exploded higher. That would be the thing that would terrify me about that.
I haven't seen it for a little while. I haven't seen it for a few months, but it was something that went around quite a lot. And it's always criticized in the same way that the Shiller PE is always criticized. Like, and I think the criticisms of the Shiller PE are legitimate. Like it's really only been around since 1996, basically hasn't worked since 1996. So I think that's a fair.
So it hasn't worked since it's been around. I like it.
Well, it's like you look at when the market diverges from the long run average, it's 1996 and it just hasn't touched it since then. So, you know, is it useless? I don't know, but I kind of like the theory of it, that you take an inflation adjusted average of 10 years of earnings. It's better than a single year PE, which can be, you know, you get a 2008 type scenario where the banks wipe out all the earnings. And then you look at the single year PE. The single year PE is sort of like a contrarian indicator. When it's high, it's actually probably a pretty good time to buy. When it's low, you know, that's because the earnings are very high.
Yeah, you actually perversely want to buy like cyclicals in the market when the single year PE is like screamingly high.
Or you want to use a different metric. You want to use like assets, replacement assets, that kind of, like Tobin's Q would be a better metric than
price to sales even.
Yeah. Even some Ken Fisher stuff right here.
that name is cursed.
I know, it's such a shame because he did write some good stuff, but I, you know, what's tough about him for me is like a lot of how I learned markets was through like, there's this Forbes book about him, 25 years of a market guru. And like, I really enjoyed that book and I really enjoyed a lot of what he wrote. And sometimes I just wonder if like these guys that are like super smart just don't understand what they're allowed to think and say. Like, he's got like major social problems. And look, like, I'm not defending what he said, and he's like clearly got some issues, but like, I don't even know if he knows he's got issues.
Yeah.
Like William Green's book touched on it. Like, some investors, they got like this touch of like, they just don't even understand that it's not right to think.
Yeah.
And that doesn't make it right. It doesn't make it okay to go out and say it, but it's just like hard for me because he did frame so much of how I think about things, and to just like not even be able to speak his name doesn't
it's
feel
okay
right.
To separate the message from the messenger too.
Low,
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Low self-awareness or low, interpersonal, low EQ.
No EQ.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
right.
It's
crazy to build like a multi-billion dollar business and have that low of EQ though. Like, that's crazy.
Only in finance can you do that.
Yeah, well, through books.
No, that's
right?
Not true. I think you can do that in tech too.
Oh yeah.
It might be an asset in tech too.
That's true.
In some ways you need to be able to hack the whatever like little limbic system drive that you're trying to target, but then not care at all about the consequences.
Yeah, like being like a little bit of a sociopath might help a lot.
As a cheery note to end the podcast.
We got 5 more minutes, don't we? We started late.
Yeah, I think we might.
Do we have no questions?
We have plenty of questions now, Jake. Yeah.
No answers, though.
I've just lots of questions, no answers. I gotta hit the half hour. Thanks, folks. So next week we've got a little change in the lineup. Bill's taking a break for a couple of weeks. We're gonna have Ian Cassell in loco parentis, or as a locum, or some one of those things.
Makes me very happy.
Who's gonna run all the bots while he's on the show?
No fans. I'll tune in. You'll have a fan. I just can't. I can't. I need some time to clear my mind a little bit.
Happy 420, everybody.
Yeah. Happy holiday.
Ciao.
Shout out to this. Shake it up, stop when the clock hits 13. Sing 1, 2, 3, 4. Cast, cast, cast. No one can do it like we do it, like we do it, like we do it. Cause no one can do it like we do it, like we do it, like we do it. Cause no one can.